This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
Welcome, everybody, to a Monday edition of the Orange Buzz Podcast. I'm Jeff Ketchum. Special thanks to our guys, our sponsors of the Orange Buzz Podcast, Texas Card House, 183 and Anderson Mill. Go check them out. They are the state of Texas's premier poker club. You can get your cash game on, your tournament game on. They are a fervent supporter of orangebloods.com and the Yak. So we love our guys over at Texas Card House. I love that they're just right down the street from me. I need to get in a tournament game this week. I might need to do some Wednesday or Thursday night poker. But look, it is a Monday edition of the podcast. Big full weekend. There's actually a lot of stuff I want to get to in the podcast today. I've got a, I think there's some interesting Texas football discussion, and I'm going to lean on, I'm going to lean on something for content that I rarely do. So apologies to Anwar Richardson in advance for kind of heading in a direction that I'm sure he will also head in. I've got a fuck Green Book take that I have to get off my chest. And like, I'm probably going to need to get some true detective discussion out of the mix as well. So I'm going to be bobbing and weaving and hitting on a lot of different things in this podcast. We'll see if I can keep it under a rational time limit. Let's start with the Texas football discussion. Look, I've never really had this happen before. It's fascinating when you think about it, but Anwar Richardson kind of stole the column that I was going to write over the weekend. and I don't mean that he like stole it. I mean, he just beat me to the punch. Like, I had this idea in my head that, man, Tom Herman's just got it cooking right now. You think about what's happening in recruiting. You think about the two most recent analyst hires, which only figure to be a couple of the analyst hires that will be made. You think about the Herb Hand decision. You think about kicking ass and beating Georgia in the Sugar Bowl and finding his quarterback. And like, there's just, he's just, if this were bowling, we'd be looking at each other like, is he going to bowl a 300? It feels like over the course of, let's say, the last 12 months or so, that he has not missed on many things. And I think that I didn't feel that way after a year. You know, I thought the stuff on the field was, in year one, was sketchy. It was uneven. You know, I never in year one thought to myself, oh, Tom Herman's special, isn't he? And then you think about the Casey Horney hire, and I wasn't a fan of that. Some of his staff hires, you know, were questionable. And I came out of year one thinking to myself, I don't know about this guy. And I feel like I was pretty open and honest about it on the board. Like, I wasn't faking it. Do you think Tom Herman wins a national championship in 2 years? And I would kind of look at people sideways when they would ask that. What are you talking about? What are you seeing that leads you to believe we're headed for that? But over the course of the last 12 months, I think Tom Herman is, I don't want to say he's pitched a perfect game. You know, they didn't beat Oklahoma in the Big 12 championship game, but they did beat them in October, and they did get there. They did lose to Maryland, but they also beat USC, and like I said, they beat Georgia in the Sugar Bowl, which just changes I feel like the way the entire season gets perceived. In this case, literally the last thing is the only thing that matters, and it matters a lot. So I was thinking about writing this column where, and I've kind of done the mea culpa before. I've admitted that Tom Herman in year two started to do the things that I didn't see him doing in year one. But the column was really just going to be a look at how many, like what, I mean, he's just on a roll right now. He's cooking. If he were James Harden, he'd be stirring the pot. Or Ezekiel Elliott. He's just in that kind of a groove. So on Sunday, I hadn't started writing. I'd only had this kind of what I've just explained to you guys. I had this thought in my head of, this is probably what I'm going to write about. But I was getting off to a late start, and thank goodness, because I open up Anwar Richardson's article, The Sunday Pulpit, and he kind of hit on the exact same thing. In fact, his opening sentence, I didn't realize this until I just now took a look at it, very similar to kind of what I just expressed, which was, it was hard for Texas football coach Tom Herman to resemble a successful Fortune 500 CEO in his first season. Absolutely. Absolutely. And yet, and I told Anwar this as soon as I was done reading his article. He did, you know, whereas I was going to focus my article more on the recent string of heaters that he's been throwing. You know, I think Anwar took a more global, you know, kind of a 2-year review, which means I won't do that article this offseason. But he did it really well. And he had remembered some things that I had kind of forgotten about, you know, one of them being the locker room improvements. I forgot about how, you know, so much has happened since then. That seems like forever ago, but Tom Herman did come in and almost immediately snapped his fingers and like, that shit just got done. It went from this is old to we got to get some new stuff in here to the new stuff being in there, like almost immediately. And, you know, Anwar actually used a quote of mine from an article where I said, when has that ever happened with anything at the University of Texas, Red Tape University? It is true. Then he goes into, he ripped up Todd Orlando's contract and made sure that if somebody was going to take Orlando from his staff, that they would have to bring big boy money to the table from $1 million to $1.7 million. And he talks about, you know, locking up Brian. First of all, identifying Brian Carrington. Like, that's a win. Brian Carrington was a nobody. Now at Texas, he is a nuclear weapon, I think, in the recruiting game. And, you know, he's made sure that in the last year that Carrington's salary gets doubled. And I have to believe that he'll be able to go to the Board of Regents or whomever he would need to go. I guess now that he technically is a full-time boss, he could just go to Chris Del Conte, who then, if it needed to go up that high, up that deep, I'm sure they could justify it. I would make the case right now that Brian Carrington is a million-dollar commodity. He won't ever get paid that much. I think his value is worth 7 figures per year, no questions asked. If you can have that kind of impact in recruiting, you are worth your weight in gold. So whatever Brian Carrington weighs, find out what that is equivalent to in terms of poundage for gold. That's what he's worth. And Tom Herman has not let anybody poach him. Tom Herman has doubled his salary. I wasn't even really thinking about it on that level. I was just thinking about the most recent things. But over the course of 2 years, yeah. You know, I think Tom Herman deserves a lot of credit for that. And then he talks about the improvement in the quarterback room, which essentially means he found his guy. And his guy goes into the Big 12 next year, either the best or the second best in the conference, depending on what you think of Jalen Hurts. Which I would have said a year ago was probably more than anything else, the number one thing that he needed to make sure. If anything could go right, hitting a home run at the quarterback position and getting that locked up to me is the biggest. That can't be overstated. Then there's the Herb Hand hire. And then there is him taking ownership of play calling duties, which I talked about last offseason until I was blue in the face. And I think I've been proven to have been correct on that. That needed to happen. He is supposed to be the special one. No offense to Tim Beck. And the offense changed dramatically. It was a much better unit with much better quarterback play, much better offense. Like, everything was better. Not to say that it was perfect, but it needed to happen, and it did. Kudos. We've talked about recruiting and the addition of playmakers. Anwar actually touched on making the assistant coaches and their new contracts, and this is part of some of Anwar's scoop from the war room, that, you know, Herman's deal with most of his assistants, Stan Drayton, Maringer, Wareheim, Giles, Jason Washington, which is interesting for me. Craig Nivar is interesting for me. Like, I would have those guys personally, I would have those guys on multi-year deals. But he's got everybody, except for the coordinators in Herb Hand. He's got, and technically Herb Hand is a coordinator, right? He's got everybody on a one-year deal, which means the anxiety levels for these dudes every year is like, I always tell the story. I remember talking to Bobby Kennedy after they won a national championship in 2005, and he had done a really good job in recruiting. And he was like, "Do you think my job is safe?" I was like, "Bobby, you just won the national championship. I think your job is safe." I don't know, man. Mac hadn't talked to me about it. Like, these assistant coaches, it's. I mean, and I don't blame them. They all got wives and kids and families and mortgages, and they have things that they have to take care of. So trust me, Herman giving these dudes one-year deals is it's an interesting thing to do. But I am with Anwar in that it does put pressure on these dudes to perform. And it's funny because I looked at Anwar's comment. It was like, a person close to the situation told me, Herman said, quote, "If you're a lead at your job, you never have to worry. Be one of the best in the country at what you do, and you'll never have to worry about losing your job," end quote. Well, that's easy to say when you have a five-year deal. But hey, man, like, I just think it's ironic. I think it's interesting because that wasn't what existed previously, as Anwar outlined in the war room. You know, there's the results on the field that we talked about. These analyst hires, like, Tom Herman legitimately has it cooking. And that was going to be my column. But then Anwar wrote it. And I told Anwar, I think you might have done a better job with this one than I was going to do. Mine is going to be slightly less overview of the entire two-year window. And again, more specific about maybe what we've seen since, I don't know, just the Big 12 championship game. Like, they lose that game, but they get into a major bowl game. They sign a top five class. They have the Brew McCoy situation happen. They win the Sugar Bowl. They have the analyst hires. They, you know, they get the Brew. I mentioned the Brew McCoy thing. You think about where they are in recruiting in 2020 right now, and what I think the pole position lead that they have with Zachary Evans. Like, they're just in the last 3 months, it's been anything but snake eyes every time Tom Herman rolls the dice. That was going to be my article, and it got written by somebody else. So all day yesterday, so I kind of, you know, when I do my column, sometimes I start in different areas, but one of the things that I like to do is be inspired with my lead. I want my lead to be great every week. That, letting you guys in, like, it's important to me. I want to write something, and when I don't, I'm disappointed in myself. That's the bar that I set for myself. The bar is, I want to write something that I feel like is so good that I might reference it in 12 months because it still has value. It still has meaning. I don't want there to be throwaways. I want there to be this idea that somebody will go back to that because something was revealed. There was a certain level of insight. That's my goal every week. And Anwar did I think Anwar's article, let me put it to you like this. I think that was one of Anwar's best columns. And I think it's the kind of column that people will say, "Hey, Anwar, do you have a link to that, you know, that column that you did that kind of outlined all of the positive things that Tom Herman has done since his first, you know, since taking the job? Because I'm in a conversation with so-and-so and I want to, like, I think it was really good." And all day yesterday, man, I wrestled with what the hell I was going to write about. And my entire column was done except for my lead. I literally sent, this is ironic, I sent my 2 through 10 thoughts to Jason to be proofread because it was like 7 o'clock at night and I didn't have anything at all. And I just, after Anwar kind of, I read his article, I just, for the rest of the day, my level of creativity as it relates to, and the one thing that I want to really do, I just didn't have time to do. Weekend got away from me. I'm going to work on it this week. It'll probably be something that I put in the war room, but that whole counting the number of visits that the elite prospects that Texas is recruiting have already made, I just didn't have time. I had to go to a car dealership. I had to go to Covert Hutto yesterday and complete my new car deal, which, by the way, I am a new owner of the Ford Tank, otherwise known as the Expedition, otherwise known as the Expedition Platinum. And I really, first of all, you know, it was one of those deals. Somebody mentioned this on the message board that, cause my wife totaled my Benz. I've been a Mercedes-Benz owner for 14 years. First I had an SL500 and then I had the E-Class, I think 350. I'm not that much of a car guy, so I don't even know that I know the Mercedes I've had since 2014. I've had two cars in the last 14 years. Me personally, my wife goes through cars like they're Tic Tacs. She's had a Mini, she has an Infiniti, she's had 4 cars in the last 10 years, and I've had 2 in the last 15. And I'm only in this new car because she totaled the other one. And thank God, the most important thing is that her and the kids were completely safe. I still don't know how that happened, but I did find myself in this car buying situation. And by the way, I've gone completely off target. So I've gone completely off the road in the podcast. Hold the car buying thought. I'll come back to that in a second. I want to put a ribbon and bow on this thought that I was talking about with the Texas football thing. But like, I just couldn't. And then I couldn't think of anything to write about for hours as it relates to this lead. Like, it just wasn't my best lead of all time. And then I started thinking, like, spring football, what the hell could I write now that could just be easy? Like, today's column was not one that wasn't my best work. But then I came up with the idea of, you know, list of players that I want to, that I've kind of been thinking about, that I'm curious about, that are a little under the radar. You know, this is a team that will come back to the table with a lot of very prominent pieces. You know, you won't be able to talk about this team without talking about Sam Ellinger or Colin Johnson or Caden Stearns or BJ Foster. I mean, there are players on this team that will come back next season as among the best in the Big 12 at their position. I was thinking about guys that are either competing for starting spots and or are kind of not even on that length, on that level. And, you know, in the end, I think it worked. It wasn't my best work. It wasn't. And ironically, there were a couple of typos in the column, but none of them were in the section that Sukumel edited. They both were. Like, I wrote the first section. There weren't any issues in it, but you know, there were two that Sukumel, throwing him under the bus a little bit. It's okay. I realize what a pain in the ass it is to try to proofread my 10 thoughts from the weekend. It's a lot of words. So, you know, as far as the rest of Texas athletics week, it was kind of a slow weekend. Baseball team was good. I think that team's going to be really interesting to watch. I don't have it in me to get into the Kerwin Roach thing. I mean, just what a disaster. I like Kerwin Roach. Seems like a good dude. I like him as a player. I like him. And yet you can't be a senior and getting suspended. I don't care what it is that he did. I don't care if it was weed. I don't care if he missed class. I don't care if he burglarized a Walgreens and took some Snickers. I don't know. Like, whatever it is that he did. And I suppose it could be any number of a million different things. There, you know, I think we all have red lights that go off into our head whenever a kid whenever I see a male athlete at the college level get suspended, I mean, there's about five things that pop up into my head. They just kind of tried and true. It's like barbecue. It's like brisket and potato salad. Put them together. It's just tried and true. It's why there's potato salad at every bar. It's just tried and true. Tried and true. But, you know, as soon as he was out for that game, you knew that Texas wasn't going to win in Norman. I'm sorry. I thought they were going to win in Norman. I think Dustin McComas thought the same thing. And then the Kerwin Roach thing happened. And I thought to myself, that's not happening. And it didn't happen. And I think you can directly look at that suspension and say, cost him a game. Cost him a needed game. Big difference between 16 and 11 and 15 and 12. Really is. Even if it's just a game. You'd like to be separated from the that 500 Mendoza line of college basketball by as much as you can. Texas basketball team, the women's team, mollywhopped, what was it, Texas Tech? I don't even remember who they played. They beat somebody by like 20-something points, but that was after they lost to Kansas State for the second time this season. I don't know what to do with the Texas women's basketball program. They bore me. That's the biggest thing. To me, even when Texas was just kind of average under Jody Conrad, like I always felt like that it was must-see stuff. Like I always watched Texas women's basketball team. I could easily put together a list of my top 10 favorite Texas women's basketball players since I've started watching women's basketball back when Clarissa Davis was playing. Like, you know, I know it was 30 years ago, but there's a high bar at this place. It's the same thing with football. The difference, you know, Texas women's basketball right now is about where the Texas football program was when Mack Brown took over. And just like it had been 30 years when Mack showed up, essentially, since Texas had won. You know, not even that long. God, 20 years. He shows up in 90. No, I guess it had been 28 years. I can't do simple math today. Sorry. That's three decades. Now, you couldn't tell Texas fans that there was a low bar that needed to be. Just win 10 games. No, Texas fans were like, fuck that. We're here to win national championships. That's what Daryl did. So that's kind of the way I look at it for the Texas women's basketball team. Like, people are like, oh, you don't, man, I know, I was there. I went to those games. I had just moved to Austin. There were more people at Texas women's basketball games than there were at the football games. And Jody felt big. Jody felt important. Jody's basketball teams, I felt like you had to watch. And then Coach G shows up. Guesting Corps shows up and, It felt like her hire was big. So her teams were interesting for a little bit until it just completely revealed that it wasn't the right fit. It wasn't the right hire. She was, in a lot of ways, the Shaka Smart hire of the women's athletic department. Looked good on paper. In reality, just not the right person for the job. Didn't work out, hasn't worked out kind of a thing. Karen Aston, this is her seventh year. And Karen Aston showed up with a low profile. And in her 7 years that she's been here, she made it to an Elite Eight. She made it to a Sweet 16. She hasn't done either of those, you know. But in women's college basketball, getting to the Sweet 16, that's nothing. That's easy. That's easy. The favorites, they all advance. One seed, two, three seeds almost always make it to the Sweet 16. Rarely are there updates or upsets at that level of the women's NCAA tournament. There's more now than there used to be, but it's still a tournament dominated by the top half of the bracket. Significantly so. It's nothing like the men's NCAA tournament. And 3 years ago, she got to an Elite Eight, and it felt like, okay, Texas women's basketball is going to be big. This is a sign. It's going to be big again. And in the last 3 years, it feels like it's been on the precipice of being big. And then Baylor slaps the taste out their mouth every single time. And Texas plays Baylor tonight in Waco. I'm predicting an ass kicking. Because Baylor's number one in the country. And Texas isn't any closer to dethroning Kim Mulkey under Karen Aston in year 7 than they were in I don't know, pick a year. There's still a wide gulf. And I just find myself not being interested in Texas women's basketball. I don't want to say I'm as apathetic to it as some of you are to the men's thing, but like, I like women's basketball. I like watching Texas women's basketball, but I just haven't done it in a while. And like, my little girl's 4. Like, I want her. If the Texas women's basketball team was really good, I would have my daughter in front of the TV with me and we'd be watching it. I'd be like, watch these girls play basketball. But I can watch really good women's basketball. I can't watch average women's basketball any more than I can watch average men's basketball. I want to like pull my eye sockets out when I watch the men play sometimes, most of the time. Even when they win, it's like, God, I want my 2 hours back. So nothing changed over the weekend on that front. Watched a little bit of both, and I regretted it both times, even though the Texas women were perfectly fine this weekend. It's kind of the principle of the matter. Okay, so I started this podcast out. Oh, so let me finish my car thing. I told you I was going to bounce around. Let's finish off the car discussion. Because I have to say, I wasn't sure that I was absolutely going to drive off with a car from Covert Hutto. I've been a Mercedes guy for 14 years. If you'd asked me a month ago, I would have told you I'm going to be in a Mercedes for the rest of my life. So I was apprehensive. You know, like, it's like having bad luck in dating and then finding someone who's similar to the person that you had a bad experience in or a good experience. Like, you know, the way you feel about things are impacted by your experiences, and my experience is where I love my Benzes. But we do have a deal with Covert Hutto. They are one of our most important partners over at orangebloods.com. They are the sponsor of the tailgate. And in a perfect world, I'd get a car from them. And wouldn't that be awesome? Like, what better better recommendation can you give than to say, yeah, man, I went there and I did the thing. And then, you know, I'm happy. But I have to admit, I didn't necessarily know that that was the way that it was going to go. Thursday, I went down to the lot, and they were like, what are you looking for in a car? And, you know, I just wanted my car back. I just wanted my Mercedes E-Class back. So I was like, you know, I mean, if you show me a sedan that is similar to what I was driving, like, you know, I could be interested in a million different things. I'm not necessarily a car guy. Every time I've bought a car, both times, it's just because I got in the car and I kind of felt it. So we were going around the dealership and looking at cars, and I was unsure. There's a part of me that was like, oh, love my Benz. And then it happened. Then they put me in a platinum version of the Expedition. And I was like, this is dope. This is all right. You know, one of my things about like midsize SUVs as a big guy is I just feel a little too crammed, and didn't feel crammed at all in the Expedition. And then I looked at the back seats and there was just tons of room so that my kids' legs wouldn't be up against the chair. Cause that's like a thing you have to think about. My kids still have to sit in car seats, and now they're tall enough and big enough at almost 5 years old that like their legs get crushed. Cause I want to have room. In the Expedition, they could sit in the back row. There's plenty of room. And then I started thinking about just going to Houston, like for the holidays. And we take my wife's Infiniti, her SUV. And I swear to God, we pack it to the rafters. There's not an inch of space left because presents and everything are everywhere. So I dug that. I was like, well, this is bigger. It'll still probably be packed to the rafters because my wife will find a way to use every bit of space that would be available. But it's bigger, and I liked it. And the technology was kind of sick, really sick. And that was one of the things that I think I really, like, I love the technology in the E-Class Mercedes that I was driving 2014. Like, I just, it'll sound, you know, I liked it. And it's probably stuff that every car has now. I don't know. I don't go shopping for cars very often. but it felt high, like, you know, high end to me. And I got in the platinum version of the Expedition, and it like took it to a completely different level. There's shit in that car from a technology standpoint that in 3 years from now, I will discover and still not know how to use. There's a function where it helps you parallel park. I have never parallel parking in an Expedition. It just never happened. If it means we have to, I'm going to admit that I am probably incapable. I'm probably incapable of parallel parking an Expedition. But there is a feature that apparently will help, like, essentially park my Expedition for me. Maybe they have the angles. I don't know. I don't parallel park. I don't even need to use it, but it's there. It is on the technology side of things. I liked it a lot. And it just kind of felt right. There was a part of me that had to, has to admit my green fingerprint on the planet is much higher. I'm going to have to find a way. I'm just going to tell you right now, I'm going to be hypocritical. I'm going to tell you that we need to do things to save the planet, but I'm going to do so while I'm driving around in an Expedition. And no, I would suggest that everybody's got a little bit of hypocrisy in them. Nobody's perfect. I try to be the best version of myself every day that I can possibly be. And 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I don't pull that off all the time. And you guys remind me of it. Like, I'll get snarky with somebody. And I know I shouldn't get snarky with somebody, but somebody got snarky with me, and I don't want to let them get away with it, so I get snarky with them. And then somebody will say, well, come on, man. Why'd you even let that person goad you into that? And I'm like, because I can't help it. I'm human. And I would say, I love this big tank that I'm driving now. It's big. I feel like Tony Soprano sitting in a big old SUV driving around. It feels good. I enjoyed it. And everybody can say, well, he would have gone buy a car from Covert Hutto anyway. It's not true. Believe me, I understood the consequences of what it would mean not to buy a car from Covert Hutto. I did, man. But you guys have to know me by now. I do make things hard on myself sometimes. And the truth of the matter is, I love the car. When I got in it, it wasn't my Mercedes. It was something completely different. And I immediately just started thinking about all of the reasons why this was really good for me. And the size and having a family and just them being at that age now where we're getting ready to take them around everywhere and not wanting to feel completely crammed together. Yes. AOC will not be happy with my car selection. Although, don't like all government officials get taken around town, taxied around town in an SUV. Isn't it safer? It's safer for all of us. The cool thing about then deciding that I really wanted the Expedition Platinum Edition was that the guys over at specifically Mark Ryland, who I enjoyed talking recruiting with, because we go way back, as it turns out. Got a little Eric Hardeman update that I wasn't ready, completely prepared for. It's not quite what, you know, not storybook finish there. But like, it was amazing how quickly I was able to get in and get out. It was not an intrusive deal. It seemed like I had to sign only a few documents. It was about as good of an experience as I could possibly imagine. Like, I got to give those guys a lot of credit. Maybe it's different. Maybe they made it easy for me. I don't know. It was really easy. They didn't have the color that I wanted in the platinum package. They went and got it, and it was there the next day. Like, all I can tell you is I dig my new ride. I realize that it's a gas guzzler, and I am going to have to work really, really hard to help save the planet. At the same time, while destroying the planet in my car. My wife loves it, by the way, though. She's less concerned about saving the planet than I am. And she has no remorse that I'm driving this tank. And I couldn't recommend the experience anymore. Like, they really did a good job. I don't mean to turn this podcast into a covert sponsorship piece. I'm just letting you know that happened to me this weekend, and I'm here to talk about it. It was a big part of my weekend. Another thing. All right, two things from TV. We got to talk about the Oscars for a moment. We have to talk about True Detective for a moment. Let's start with the Oscars. Fuck Green Book. And I know my audience. Look, here's what I know. White people love Green Book. It is an easy movie for white people to love. You have the lead character, who's not really the lead character, but because the lead character is Dr. Don Shirley, who this movie couldn't exist without, which part of my problem is that the most important character in the movie is the one that's kind of marginalized for this other character, this white man, who's racist. Like, the movie couldn't portray it. He's pretty disgustingly racist. Racist enough, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the movie, this isn't a huge spoiler, a black person comes over, I think, to fix his refrigerator in the movie, and his wife gives him a glass of water to drink from, and when Viggo Mortensen's character sees that a black person drank out of one of his glasses, he throws the glass in the trash. Like, he's that racist. And over the course of the movie, this really racist character, who's like a normal, funny, charming white guy, but this one little thing, like, he's really super racist. But hey, he's a tough guy from New York, and he can hustle, and he's funny, and he's incredibly charming with his... this is a terrible New York accent. I apologize. But, you know, he's got, like, that whole shtick going, right? Like, hey, oh, hey. And he's very charming. The writing for his character is really charming. Hey, Dr. Shirley, why don't you eat some fried chicken? It's tasty. Like, we white people are just eating that shit up. They love it. They love the character. And he's a great character. And Viggo Mortensen does a really good job. Like, he totally nails that New York guy. And then over the course of the movie, this really racist white dude starts to realize, oh, shit, man. Like, my level of racism is unhealthy. Because Don Shirley, as a black human being, is like a human being. And, you know, they helps him out, drives him around, tells him funny jokes, teaches him about Aretha Franklin, teaches him about eating fried chicken. At the end of the day, when the black guy, who also happens to be homosexual, which is two things that white men oftentimes can be really freaked out about, when the black man has a homosexual encounter and the white man has to save him. And at the end of the movie, the white guy is a little less racist than he was before. Oh, it's movie of the year. Oh, white people love a movie where the white person gets to be flawed, but then overcomes their flaw and then saves the day. There's just so much wrong with Green Book. So much wrong. And I know that every single one of you listening to this podcast that has seen Green Book, because most of you that listen to this show are white dudes. I know you guys are like, if you've even made it this far, the moment, because this is my social justice warrior moment of the week so far. I've been holding this fucking Green Book rant inside of me for months. And I cannot talk about it on the message board. And I will ignore you if you challenge me on the, because I can't talk about it on Orange Bloods. I vowed I would not bring the conversation to Orange Bloods, but goddamn it, I didn't say I wouldn't bring it to the Yak. And yesterday, Green Book wins the, and look, admittedly, there wasn't a great, I don't think there was a slam dunk, should have, no doubt about it, won Best Picture. I can't find the film. I cannot tell you what should have won Best Picture. Personally, I think A Star is Born is my favorite musical. I think, like, of that variety, that kind of theme, it's my favorite movie of its genre I've ever seen. I loved it. But it is a remake of a remake of a remake. So I get it. I get it. If someone wanted to say, you can't give the Best Picture to a movie that's already been done a couple of times and done very well, Although I would contend that this is the best version of A Star Is Born, and it's the third one nominated for an Oscar. It's just Green Book wasn't the winner. And I know what you guys are like. Let me just lay it out. Let me lay out just a few reasons why. Besides the fact that it is a bit of a white savior movie. I hate what they did with Don Shirley. The maker of this movie can say whatever he wants to about like that Don Shirley said that when he was dead. Think about this. When you're dead, you can write a movie that kind of talks about whatever layers of like friendship you think we had. But dude, you need to wait till I'm dead because I sure as shit don't want to see it while I'm living. Like, think about that. Let me just tell you right now, if the answer to any question you ever ask me is wait till I'm dead, that means I don't want that shit to go down, man, but I can't stop you. So if you could just wait till I'm in the ground is a hell of a like license, isn't it? But this is a movie made by white people. In part about a gay black person's experience in the 60s, and they made no attempts to really like bring accuracy and layers of insight into the portrayal of the most important character in the movie. We get a caricature of what a white person might think of Don Shirley. They didn't contact Don Shirley's family. They didn't try to. The word today, and has for the last couple of, we didn't even know Don Shirley had a family. Man, if you didn't know that Don Shirley had a family and that he was close to him, and oh, by the way, it's not portrayed that way in the movie, how well did you really know Don Shirley? Well, we didn't even know he was close to his brother. Then you weren't that good of a fucking friend. Huh? Maybe. And then last night, they win multiple awards and they never thank Don Shirley. How do you make a movie and then about a man while seeking zero input from anyone else that would have known the man? You have caricaturized his homosexuality. You have caricaturized his blackness as a man. This just in, Tony Lip didn't teach Don Shirley how to eat a piece of fried fucking chicken. And, oh, by the way, he didn't need to be taught who Aretha Franklin was. He was friends with Aretha Franklin. The entire portrayal of this movie is seen through the prism of a white guy. And everything about it is this movie was made to make white people feel good. And if you're a white man and you watch this movie and you loved it, ask yourself why you loved it. Because you have to know that this movie came without nuance. You had to know that the portrayal of Don Shirley couldn't remotely be the way that it existed in real life. That the level of complexity for that human being had to have been such that it warranted further, like deeper examination. Doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. And the fact that this movie is about Don Shirley, but it's his driver that's the lead character, doesn't that tell you everything? So go ahead. Love Green Book. I'm just saying, ask yourself what you would think about this movie if you happen to be looking at it through the prism of Don Shirley instead of the reformed racist white guy who's just charming enough that you want to overlook the fact that he's really, really racist. But at the end of the movie, he's a little less racist. Problem of the earth solved. Racism solved. Good. Everybody go home. Be safe. Good night. All right. Done with that. Other than to say, I hope Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga get together and have babies. I love them as a couple. That's my only other Oscars comment. Everything else kind of went according to plan. It just wasn't a great year for movies. But there's no excusing Green Book. None. 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 If you walked out of that movie and you were like, that was good. That's who you are. To me, if you walk out of Green Book and you're like, that's one of the best goddamn movies I've ever seen in my life. That was good. You are like the dude in Coming to America who watched Sexual Chocolate sing, I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Like, if you listened to Sexual Chocolate, do Whitney Houston, and at the end of it, you were like, that boy is good. God damn, that boy is good. If you're that guy, that's who you are. You're that guy watching Sexual Chocolate sing Whitney Houston at the end of it. You thought you, that's what I think of you today. You're that guy. Because there are so many problems with that movie that if you walk out of it just completely unaware of like what those problems might be, you are fucking too white for your own good. Wow, never thought about it. Huh. Maybe it would have been a good idea when a movie about Don Shirley to get some perspective from someone else who might have known Don Shirley really, really well. Instead of just a little bit well. Oh, God. I can already tell. This part of the podcast is going to get me in trouble. True Detective. We'll finish the podcast with a little bit of True Detective. I don't know what to think. Spoiler alert. Look, you should not listen to the end of this podcast if you have not yet seen the end of the season's True Detective. I was not expecting... I knew that a lot of questions had to be answered. It felt like for a show that for 7 weeks went to great pains and detail to be very meticulous in its creation of the questions that still needed to be asked. And it's been great for, I felt like episode 8 was a completely different show than the first. I guess that's my biggest problem. The methodology was the same, the flashbacks, like there was some really interesting, I thought, directing and cinematography, if you will. But in, as a whole, I did not feel that episode 8, the final episode of the season, I just didn't think it meshed well with episode 7. We get the reveal pretty quickly, early in the episode. This whole season, as it turns out, wasn't really about the crime. In the end, the crime was pretty easy. It was one of those things that'd be the very first thing we suspected after episode 1. But then it took us down all of these paths and caused us to second guess ourselves and wonder just how convoluted is it all. And then at the end, it wasn't very convoluted. It was pretty easy. It was like, how is this not solved in 1980? And like, I know how it wasn't. I watched the show, but this all seemed real easy. And there's a part of me that is happy, like to the credit of the show makers. Like it had a happy ending, I suppose. It ends with, Hayes and Roland and Hayes's family drinking lemonade, sitting in rocking chairs on a beautiful day, and just kind of sharing some fellowship. I love, people are like, you're wrong. Hayes, Roland ended up not being a bad guy. Well, you're right. And I'm glad. Like, I didn't want Roland to turn heel. But I kept thinking that surely there was something in this final episode that would be like, whoa, holy shit, that just happened. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen. There was not a holy shit that just, and I look, man, I've been on pins and needles for a week. So I don't really care how the show ended, but God damn it, they owed me a holy shit that just happened moment. And it really didn't happen. You could see the scene where he runs into Lucy and you knew he was going to like in mid thought, forget where the hell he was. You just knew that was going to happen. So there just wasn't that, it just didn't have that season deserved a stick the landing finale. And I don't know that that happened. I didn't, as a viewer who loved the first 7 episodes, I did not love the finale. It just left me a little bit empty. I was a little bit disappointed. I needed more. That's the second time now that True Detective has gone through seasons where every episode leading up to the finale has been an A+, and then they give me like a B- in the season finale, and it sticks out. It's like season 5 of The Wire. It's like Godfather 3. The last thing, the lasting memory of the story really does matter. Especially in television. You can make a Godfather 1 and a Godfather 2, and they can stand alone, and you can say, well, Godfather 3 doesn't ever keep me from watching Godfather 1 and 2. But this might, like, I don't know. I still have to completely process. There's also a theory. There's also some interesting theories. But given the way the show ended, it's hard for me to, like, want to buy into the crazy theories that exist with this idea that possibly what really happened was that Roland died. Not Roland, but that Hayes died in Vietnam, and that this was the final scene where he's on the porch and then it like goes into his eye and then he ends up a soldier in Vietnam. There's a theory out that what really happened was that he never came back from Vietnam and that he's stuck in the afterlife trying to process it all. And that whole storyline was his way of trying to work through a suitable ending that would allow him in the afterlife to find relief. And there was, I saw something on Vanity Fair, I think, that tied some imagery from the end of the season to things that would have inspired the imagery in itself and some of the storytelling, and I just didn't have time for it. I was like, wait a minute. I've been trying to do the conspiracy thing and figure out a complicated crime for weeks, and the season finale made me feel like an idiot for overthinking all of this, and now you want to tell me that I haven't overthought it enough? Is that what you're trying to do? Overthink. Not very hard thinking. Oh, now go back to overthink? Like, it's just hard for me to do that. With great apologies to True Detective Reddit and Vanity Fair and those that are trying to overthink it at the end. If it was something like that, that 99% of the people who watch the TV show wouldn't have recognized that, does not make you a genius. Oh, I could created something where at the end, nobody really knew what I was trying to pull off. It means you're a shitty storyteller. That's what it means. You're a shitty storyteller. If at the end Hayes was really dead the entire time, and that one shot at the end of him in the jungle was supposed to be proof of that, then you suck as a storyteller. That is, you told a long ass story, and then the big aha at the end. No, so I'm just gonna believe it's as straight, as simple as we're led to believe it is, which makes it all very disappointing. And on that note, I hope you forgive me for my Green Book rant. I just had to get that out of my system. So don't let y'all's your feelings be hurt because you liked Green Book and you just haven't given it a nearly enough thought. Just my opinion. Just saying. I'll talk to you later this week.